Welcome to Idle Red Hands, a podcast from Japan about gaming and gamer life.
And welcome to Idle Red Hands. I'm Wayne.
I'm Lyle.
Once again, no Chris.
Well, I figured out what that mystery sauce was in my freezer.
How did you find that out?
Just by eating it, yeah.
Okay, did you like sniff it first or something? Because this is a comic book. This is how someone would get superpowers. Real world, this is how you get like botulism or something.
Well, after I thought it, I opened up the container and figured out it was a curry.
Okay.
And then after I cooked it and then poured it onto the plate, I figured out it was a tomato-based curry. It was a little bit soupy, so I had to put it in a bowl. It had been there a long time.
Okay.
Yeah. And it's funny, though, because the meat that I used for that curry when I originally made it, that meat had been in the freezer a long time, so I didn't want to cook it on its own. So to salvage it, made it into a curry.
Right.
And then didn't eat all of the curry, and then put the rest of it in the freezer, and then forgot about that.
Right.
So
did you eat all of the mystery sauce then?
Yeah.
Oh, so you should have continued the cycle and left some of it, you know, turned it into something else, and then frozen and forgotten about that.
I didn't dare.
You know, it's like those stories here of like, you know, the big pots of ramen or the big pots of soup and stuff. You just keep, you know, chucking things in and keep it going pretty much continuously.
Yeah, I could have done that, yeah.
But you didn't, okay.
No, I'm living the bachelor life, though, so I'm just eating anything in the house that's still here.
Okay, I was going to say, living the bachelor life is probably a good excuse to do exactly that, so.
Yeah, so I got a bunch of packages of ramen I got to get through. Looking forward to that.
I'm sure you are, yeah. Next, you'll be telling me you've gone down to bread crusts that you can get for free from the convenience store, yeah.
Can you get that for free?
Supposedly. Well, honestly, where do you think all the crusts from the crustless sandwiches here go?
Oh, okay. I didn't think of that. I thought they just threw it out.
They probably do. Or they get made into like panko or something, though. Breadcrumbs.
I do know that's where the homeless people go when they want food, is the convenience store, and eat the expired food.
Yep. I know that too.
Yeah. I have a convenience store near my house that doesn't seem to have a lot of homeless people around it, so maybe one. So okay. Not a lot of competition, but I wanted to do that.
On that cheerful note, yeah.
Yeah, I'm not starving, I'm just lazy.
Okay, I'm glad we've established that. Yeah.
Too lazy to fight a homeless person for rice balls. It's like, maybe I'll just buy something.
Anyway, no segue at all, because I'm not sure how to go from homeless people to talking about this, but Evil Hat Productions just released a revised edition of Monster of the Week, which is kind of the Supernatural or Buffy the Vampire Slayer style, you know, kind of powered by the Apocalypse game. And, yeah, pretty excited about that, although I kind of had mixed feelings since they're putting new art in the revised edition from different people, and I don't know, the artist that they got for the original I felt was kind of so iconic that, not making sense, but it kind of feels like it's not really Monster of the Week anymore to me.
I can see how art can shape how you view a game. I mean, it's hard to divorce Vampire the Masquerade from the Brad Street art that it had in it.
Right.
Yeah.
And I'm sure the new art, like I haven't looked at the book, got a review copy because I had purchased the original Monster of the Week and, you know, so got the revised edition for free. Haven't looked at it yet, but I'm sure that the art in it is fantastic. It's just kind of a different style, and so the game will feel different.
I wonder why they didn't use the original artist.
They did for a lot of the pieces, but they put in some new art.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So it's not as if it's completely new, but yeah, I just like to complain and found something to complain about, but yeah.
Well, I'm going to complain about Bundle of Holding because that just keeps tempting me.
Oh, really? Oh, I thought you were going to have like bad news where you didn't get it, but you're just going to complain about how it keeps sucking money out of your wallet because it's so cool.
Yeah, forcing me to eat mystery sauce. the latest one is Unis System. It's always like things that I've actually wanted to try, like one roll engine.
Right.
I did have Godlike, but I didn't have like wild talents in that, so got that, and now I'd like to get Unisystem, which is a CG Corella's system. It was Conspiracy X is one of them, Witchcraft,
okay.
I think is another one, yeah.
Was that also Buffy the Vampire Slayer?
Yeah, I think they use that system to make Buffy the Vampire Slayer, yeah.
Okay.
And All Flesh Must Be Eaten.
Which I've heard a lot about or seen mentioned a lot, but haven't looked at it at all.
And we're going to be restarting your leverage game.
Yes.
Maybe tomorrow. Yeah, looking forward to that.
Yeah. Nah, it's not so much a restart, but, you know, it being so episodic that, you know, you finish one job and it's just another job after that. So, yeah, this will just be a new job for you guys. And, yeah, I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah, it's been a while. We took a long time off.
Yes, we did. Real life is kind of a pain.
Yeah, a lot you can read into that comment. Anyway, so moving along. So in this episode, we're going to be doing another literature lesson, which is a series we haven't done for quite some time. And for those who are unfamiliar with literature lessons, it's where we take an author or a theme and we look at certain elements that are prevalent in the works and then talk about how you can use those in the game. And in today's episode, we're going to be talking about Robert E. Howard, probably most famous for writing the Conan books, but he's also written like Call of the Conqueror. He's written some books on some stories on the Crusades. But definitely somebody who he actually wrote some Lovecraftian stuff as well.
Yeah, he did.
Yeah.
Or they were contemporaries and kind of inspired each other a bit, so yeah.
Yeah, they actually communicated with each other.
I think Robert E. Howard also wrote some like boxing and Western stuff. Maybe some kind of like Oriental adventure stuff as well. Not for the Dungeons & Dragons campaign, but, you know, kind of the pulp era stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So definitely some pulp era material. And he's somebody we've been talking about for a while about wanting to do a literature lesson for him. So we finally got around to it.
Yeah.
So for our first theme, we're actually going to start at pretty much the first thing that you would see when you look at a Robert E. Howard story, and that's the title. And it sounds a little bit strange, but we also think that that might be a good starting point when you start creating an adventure, is starting with the title. And the thing we like to pull out is the word of.
I'm laughing, but I mean like...
And that's self-explanatory. So moving on to the second one. Yeah. But we're looking at like the Red Blades of Black Cathay.
Are you looking at the Jewels of Gwalior, the Tower of the Elephant? What else? I'm suddenly drawing a blank for all these of. Yeah.
Should have written them down.
I know. I'm thinking that too. As many Conan stories as I listen to, and now I'm drawing a blank. But were pitching this on the...
Sorry, I got a couple more.
Okay, go ahead. Yeah.
I have the book next to me that's all of titles. But
Okay.
The Gates of the Empire, The Shadow of the Vulture, the Crusades book that I'm looking at.
I thought it was Outremer. Okay.
Is it? Well, we'll just cut that out.
Okay.
The Sours of the Thunder, which might be a bad example because people are going to go, what's Sours? I don't know.
Yeah, really. Yeah. No.
But I mean, if you think to some classic D&D modules, you're looking at Temple of Elemental Evil.
Right.
Hidden Shrine of Tamamachan, slur the words. Vault of the Drow.
Yeah. I mean, even kind of like newer modules. I mean, the flagship adventure module for Dungeons & Dragons 5th edition was Horde of the Dragon Queen. Other kind of retro clone games that are, you know, for new systems, but trying to evoke those kind of old school pulp era D&D modules. I mean, use of. I mean, you're looking at like Fane of the Frog God or other things like that. So, yeah, I mean... I think you said it really well last night, where the directness of the title really works. I mean, using that Conan story, Tower of the Elephant.
There's going to be a tower.
Right. Probably an elephant somewhere. Yeah. Or metaphorical or otherwise, you know, or you know, the D&D Temple of Elemental Evil. Right there, that tells you pretty much everything you need to know about the adventure, at least what you'll be doing.
Yeah. And like you said, it evokes a certain tone, it definitely has a pulp feel to it because of those classic short stories from people like Robert E. Howard. And it forces you to take two elements and link them right in the title. And that's a good starting point. I mean, you got John Carter from Mars. I mean, that's Edgar Rice Burroughs. But, you know, you have your main protagonist and he's going to be on Mars.
Right.
Boom. Red Blades of Black Cathay. Okay, you have a location, Red Blades. It's going to be a very bloody, very violent type of game. So, yeah. And, I mean, when you look at when people speak about Robert E. Howard and they talk about his use of language and how that helps suck you into the world, I mean, right from the title, it'll suck you into the planning. Even you don't even have to share it with the players, but if you've got that as your starting point, and then just go from there.
Yeah, I mean, if you're the GM, it would definitely help you stay on track when you're planning the adventure or when you have to, you know, improv a lot of stuff because the characters go off the rails. It would help you to know what your adventure is about, and that like one sentence kind of description of the whole adventure you're planning would help you do exactly that. But I also think...
Telling your players as well?
Yeah, I would say go ahead and tell your players, because if you are trying to evoke that kind of pulp-style Robert E. Howard story at your game, just like the title pretty much directly tells you what the story is about, the story itself is usually pretty direct. And so I don't see any problem with telling your players the name of the adventure and then going, oh, great, got it, because then the story will have the directness that is present in those pulp era Robert E. Howard stories.
Yeah, I mean, you could say, we're going to play a fantasy game, and people are like, okay, what's it about? And I said, well, I'm not going to get too much into it. But I'm going to call it the Red Blades of Black Cathay.
Right.
And then people go, okay, so kind of Asian flavor, and this is going to be a pretty lethal game. Yeah, and you just like go from there. Yeah, and you want to give them more information. It's like, oh, I'm setting it in the Crusades or something like that. That's fine, but you might not need to go beyond the title. And we've always talked about in previous episodes how when people plan together, like the players and the game master plan together from the beginning, then it's going to be a more successful game. And then people are going to coordinate. The players will coordinate with each other. They'll coordinate with the game master. And then you're minimizing the chance of somebody coming with an inappropriate character or a disruptive character.
Right, right.
And then people feel like they've been involved from the start in making this game, making this world. So they're going to be more invested in it.
If you do it right from the beginning, yeah, I think even pitch the game as, okay, here's the title of the fantasy game we're going to play. Make characters who would be involved in that story, whatever you think it is, you know, and because the titles are usually so direct, I mean, your players will probably have a pretty decent idea of something that's going to happen that's, you know, kind of in there.
Yeah, I mean, I can understand where you might not want to reveal the bad guy, you know, like you don't want to have the white ape of the Red Forest.
A lot of colors there.
Yeah, it's kind of, it was certainly, I was reaching there.
Yeah.
But I mean, if you had, again, going back to like Gates of the Empire, that's the name of it. And like, well, that's pretty open. And you're like, absolutely. So you help me decide what kind of game this is going to be.
Mm-hmm.
But this is as much tone as I want to set. Gates of the Empire. And they're like, whoa, I'm going to think A Last Stand. I'm thinking more exploration. And just from that title can get everybody's creative juices flowing. And then everybody shares some ideas. So, whoa, I'm going to be like kind of an explorer. Or somebody's like, I'm a fallen noble and I want to find or save my empire and go from there. And then that will shape the game. And that leads us into our second element, and which is just the language that Robert E. Howard used. I mean, we said that, I think, again, Stephen King said the words like just jump off the page, or the energy just jumps off the page. And it's just like electric when Robert E. Howard is at his finest. And I know, I don't know, are you a fan of box text? Because I think you've been wavering. You would rail against box text, but then you seem to be on board sometimes.
Yeah, yeah. I think box text is great for setting, I don't know, the tone or mood of the story. Or the adventure you're playing in, but I think I'm not a fan of classic dungeon crawl, every room having box text, you know?
Yeah, I think I definitely see a place for box text. It can be a great way to start the session, or if you're introducing a particularly important NPC, it's good to have some prepared text. It can be very hard to think of things on the fly, and if you're really trying to capture the tone of somebody like a Robert E. Howard, who some of the things that he uses is that like most of his nouns and verbs are modified.
Okay.
So there's not a fireplace. There's an ill-ventilated fireplace.
Right, right.
I mean, you don't have a sword. You have a long, heavy, serrated, double-edged sword.
No, I think, and this may have come up when we were talking about our hard-boiled game, because you were inspired by
James Ellroy.
Yes, exactly. James Ellroy. And he has a very distinctive writing style. And you, I thought, did a good job of bringing that across when we were playing the game. And you're right. The descriptions that Robert E. Howard has of people, places, and things, and that kind of short, punchy, I forget what it's called. I would have called it like alliteration, but it's something else where he uses a bunch of similar sounds in the same sentence with, hey, like I just did. And yeah, those modified nouns and verbs. Trying to capture that style would be a good case for having box text. At the beginning of the scene, you know, when they go into a new place that you're expecting them to go, because, you know, players always go off the rails again. Read that, and that will kind of help get everybody in the mood, or really, I don't know, kind of highlight Robert E. Howard's style, because that's what you're trying to do if you're pulling this out.
Not only does it set the tone, or introduce an NPC, it could be a great way to get people excited about a magic item they found. So it's not a plus one magic sword. It's like, it's a crescent, it's saw-edged, it's jagged, it's, you know, a sliver, a piece of the moon. I don't know, I'm not Robert E. Howard, but taking a moment, I mean, if that magic sword is important enough that you think the players would be excited to receive it, then describe it, right? Write a nice description of it. Mm. And that gets people excited about it. And you can write in hints as to what it does as well. If the players stumble upon some runes and you would like them to be intrigued or a little unnerved by the runes, then describe it. Modify everything. Every noun that you describe should be modified to just, you know, it should be dripping atmosphere.
Yeah, and that even extends to dialogue. I would say that extends to dialogue that characters can say. Like, you know, he's... At least, again, in the Conan stories, there's a lot of kind of boastful language before fights start, you know, where people, you know, insult each other and, I don't know, just the way they talk, or like one of the quotes is like, you know, you can't hit me, I was not born to die on Hyrcanian steel, you know, try again, pig of Turan. So, I'm not suggesting that you should have all these canned responses that you, the GM, or the players for that matter, could, you know, read off, because anything done to excess is going to get, you know, boring and kind of, you know, trite. But maybe for like a boss fight or someone important, I could see trading those insults, again, using that language to really kind of draw people into the mood and tone of the story. Except if you get the players who just go, okay, now I'm running through with my sword. I'm like, wait, I didn't finish my monologue, you know, I didn't finish my taunt.
Roll for initiative.
Yep. read your audience and, you know, kind of know when you can do that, when you can't. Because you're right, sometimes players are just going to be like, okay, can I roll initiative now?
Oh yeah, there was ways to build into it. There's ways to entice the players to do that. I know when we were playing 4E... Chris had the rule of if you described your action, then you would get a bonus to hit.
Right.
But you can even do, if you make a boast or make a challenge while you're fighting, if you taunt, I mean, it doesn't mean you need to give them a taunt power, but you can give them some sort of bonus, or if they, you know, if whether it's experience, so afterwards, if they dispatch them, or a bonus to hit, or a bonus damage, or even a minus for them to hit you, if which might be more in keeping to the taunt. But yeah, it definitely helps make the battle more exciting. And if you're playing in like a larger group, now I'm playing in a Rifts game where it's about six players. And it's fine. The combats don't drag by any means, but you do have time waiting for when it's your turn. And that's time to think of some sort of, you know, snappy, not really comeback, but snappy taunt or something like that. And encouraging the players to use, even if they're just making it up, but dropping names like place names or like names of a group of people that's in your world. Again, they could just be making it up, but as long as they're not sounding like, you know, they're from modern times or whatever.
Yeah.
And then it sucks people into the game a little bit more. They get more into it. They get more involved.
No, it's kind of like coming up with slang for things, you know? But, I mean, again, using Conan as an example, there are very common, you know, kind of curses and threats that I've been regaling you for a while in my emails at work that I'm sure you're sick of.
Yeah, I'm really appreciating that.
Yeah.
and the thing is, you can make a lexicon. Now, there's certain things that Conan has, like Crom, the Crusades book, it's set in, like, the Crusades, but our own history. So you can even drop stuff like the Mongolians or the like Cathay, you know, more ancient way of referring to China.
Right.
Yeah. But like writing out a lexicon of things that people could do, like slang or place names or people names. And we did that for Hard Boiled, where we went to the 1950s and we were trying to make it really hard boiled. So, I mean, it was just regular slang, but there was also, uncomfortable words or like the kind of swear words that you might hear around that time. And it just to get people involved and just, you know, people didn't have to use them, but it was there and people were encouraged to use it and everybody had that resource to draw from.
Yeah.
So if you do, you know, you make something up and it's like, well, here are some commonly referred to gods, Mitra, Crom, or things like that. I mean, or whatever is in your world. I mean, if you're doing Greyhawk, Paylor, everything, people know that. But people know about the cosmology, but if you're like Paylor's ghost and you're just like, yeah, it's a common, you know, swear word or thing that people say, or then people get more involved, you know, they're not just saying the F word or things like that. They're going to use what is the swear word of Greyhawk. I'm not quite sure. Battlestar Galactica and they say frack.
Yeah.
Yeah, and they drop it and drop it and you're like, well, you know, it's kind of a safe word. because it's not the F word, but it also draws you in more into that world.
Yeah, it does. And I was thinking that hard-boiled game, I think part of that was to make us feel uncomfortable. And so, yeah, you were, you know, using those slang words. But it, you're exactly right about, you know, Battlestar Galactica using frack as kind of like a safe curse word. And I think if you're doing fantasy, that's what, you know, the using the gods or using things in the setting does. It's kind of like a safe way to curse, you know, or it's like a safe way to refer to a character's ethnicity or, you know, characters who come from like a certain region because they're not real people. And, you know, I'm not suggesting that your characters be racist, but again, looking at Conan stories, like people get described as where they are from quite often. And there are, like, insults that go along with it, and, yeah, you obviously don't want to use real-world stuff.
I suppose you have to be a little bit careful there, but, I mean, reading the Crusade short stories, and you're talking about the Mongolians and describing them, you know, a squat, which is not so offensive. They weren't a tall people, and they rode horses a lot, so they'd be bow-legged in that. But Robert E. Howard didn't shy away from describing, like, the physical differences.
No.
People might not want to hear that, but trying to think of descriptions that would get people to think of the differences in people kind of gets them thinking about just how different people are and how you're in a different place. So people aren't all white or black or whatever sitting around your table.
Right, right.
They're this. Yeah.
I think that's a good point. And like, it's kind of funny, like listening to all the Conan audiobooks I have, the number of times that Conan gets described is kind of ridiculous. Like it reminds me a little bit of Twilight, where, you know, the author, Stephanie Meyer, describes like Edward, that vampire, a lot, you know, and it's kind of the same thing. And the lavish attention that gets put on, Conan's physical appearance and muscles and all this stuff, it is a little bit ridiculous. But as you said, it's a way to show that everyone in this setting is not exactly the same. Because when another person gets described, usually they talk about, you know, features, either, as you said, they're like either squat or bow-legged or, you know, flat-faced. And then usually their skin color gets described, their hair color. I mean, this is all kind of brief. And you, by the end of the story, or after listening to like a couple of these short stories, you have a pretty decent idea of what these different peoples look like and kind of what their character is. And so, A, it's a way to highlight that, yeah, everybody's not the same and you are in a different place and people maybe are going to look at you differently because you are white-skinned and blue-eyed like Conan and, you know, in Agrippor or whatever. But the other thing it does is it kind of sets up, I guess, maybe not a baseline, but after a couple times of doing so, like your players are going to know, oh, we're dealing with this type of person. I now have this mental image in my mind of what that person probably looks like because of the number of times you've described what other people from that region or ethnicity look like. And you even kind of get into, I guess, a little bit of, like archetypes or personality if all of the people from this region are kind of, you know, this way, kind of, you know, brusque and no-nonsense. Well, then the people are going to expect, or your players are going to expect that. You could play with it a little bit further down the line.
Yeah, which gets into our next element, and that's like a physicality or an aestheticism, where the surface does reveal a lot about the person's character, or it reveals a lot about a place. So an unpleasant place is going to be dark and dank and
usually
dirty.
Smell like urine and rotting refuse.
Evil characters are going to look or feel evil in the description. Now, it's not to say that a beautiful person won't do ugly things, but even the way when you describe their beauty, it's kind of like a cold, haunty beauty.
Right, right.
As opposed to something warm and delicate. When Robert E. Howard describes somebody that looks pure, they're going to be pretty pure.
Well, it's definitely about how they're described and the physicality. And I think you said it before, Lyle, where you're probably not going to be surprised by a character in a Robert E. Howard story because the way they look is pretty much exactly how you expect them to act and what their personality is going to be.
Yeah, I mean, even a protagonist. There's one story where it's an Englishman who's a fat drunk, and there's nothing appealing about his physical appearance, and there's really not much that's appealing about his personality as well. And you follow along, and I actually was a bit curious why Robert E. Howard would pick this person as a protagonist, but it's most like you follow him along as he bumbles along through this adventure and watching sort of the things that transpire or the things that happen from his actions. But yeah, at the end of the story, you're not surprised that he ends up or he does the things that he does.
Right.
And you certainly not, you don't sympathize with him because he, from the beginning, he's described as an unappealing human being.
Right.
Whereas Conan or Call, who's like a proto Conan, you know, they're described, you know, like powerful. I mean, they're dangerous. They, at least with Call, I'm not so sure if Conan got this description a lot, but described as pretty much like a panther.
Oh, yeah.
A human panther.
And Robert E. Howard loved his panther with Conan, too.
He loves the panthers. Yeah.
No, yeah, you're right, because Conan gets kind of described as grim and, you know, kind of everything about Conan's body, since I've heard about it so much, is pretty utilitarian, you know, and that's exactly what Conan's personality is, you know. It's pretty grim. Not going to say there's not a lot going on upstairs, because he's actually quite smart, but, I mean, he doesn't mess around and doesn't do things without a reason to do them.
Mm. And when you're just saying that, it's like a hard man or a hard woman looks hard.
Right.
Someone who's had a soft life will look soft.
Right.
I mean, Robert E. Howard doesn't cheat.
Right.
So the soft individual is not going to turn out to be an amazing fighter.
You're absolutely right. Because again, thinking of some of the Conan stories where he teams up with the Red Hawk, and yeah, of course, she is this typical Robert E. Howard woman where she's nothing but like curves everywhere, but then like her hands have sword calluses. Or there's been other times, because a lot of Conan stories are kind of like mysteries, or at least kind of whodunits, you know, and you know, this kind of foppish noble, Conan will notice calluses on their hands that are not work calluses, because a swordsman knows swordsman calluses, you know. And so yeah, it's like Robert E. Howard doesn't cheat. But I was wondering, or I was thinking about, of course, one is a story, right? And reading a Robert E. Howard story, you can see characters interacting that in a game, the characters and the players wouldn't see. Kind of like the big bad of the story. Usually, you know, right from the prologue, that this character is pretty evil based on the way they are described.
Mm-hmm.
And usually we get to see this person interacting with other characters to just drive home even more how bad this person is.
Yeah, you know something? I think there's a good point, and I think you've already made it, but I just want to touch upon it a little bit more, and it's the calluses.
Mm-hmm.
When you were saying, like, she's got, like, calluses of a sword fighter, or the foppish or effeminate noble has got those calluses as
right.
Well. And he often talks about the eyes, like the hard eyes,
mm-hmm.
the big innocent eyes, searching yep. eyes. You know, when people make perception checks, often we're tempted to give them the information.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
It's like, oh yeah, he's lying, she's lying, or he's a fighter, looks dangerous, as opposed to just describing what they're physically seeing, as opposed to telling them what they should be thinking from what they're physically seeing. And I know you're not a fan of when game masters do that. They give too much information.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, but you see the noble. Okay, I'm going to do a perception check. Okay, this is what you physically see. You see that sweat rolling down his forehead, or he's saying this. He's being very friendly. His eyes are very hard.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what does that mean? I don't know. Maybe this is just a hard man. Or it could be that he plays things very close to the chest, or is very guarded, or he hates the players.
Right.
Yeah, but it, you know, give them a lot of information, but make sure that information is only physical, like what they would physically see with their eyes, and then the players can make their own conclusions.
Right, and it doesn't have to go only for the character that the player characters are interacting with, even though,
oh, absolutely.
Yeah, the eyes, the calluses, that's all great. But other times we've had, like, worn sword hilts in this person that
example
looks
I was
like,
thinking of. Yep, yeah.
Well, yeah, glad we're on the same track there, but you're like,
because I think it comes up every story.
Yeah, pretty much. Just like, okay, you know, wow, that sword hilt is worn. Oh, again, another fighter, right? But no, that's a really good point. You know, maybe, you know, clothes are too fancy, or, you know, you kind of have that nervous sweat that comes down, or, you know, I don't know, the way a character walks, you know?
Or, it's like, or the height, you know? I mean, I'm not saying that Robert E. Howard is simplistic. I mean, he wants you to know who's powerful. He wants you to know who's the leader. So the leaders tend to be taller than everybody else.
And bigger.
And bigger than everybody else.
But always just a hair's breadth less bulky than Conan.
Yeah. But not too big.
You know? Exactly.
Still able to move like a panther.
Right. Again, the number of times when, like, surprisingly quickly for one of his bulk has been written in the Robert E. Howard story is a lot.
I remember reading The Dark Knight Returns, and I read that before I read any Robert E. Howard. stories, and there's an antagonist in the story described as like really big, but not big enough to interfere with the movements. And I forget exactly how Frank Miller wrote it, but I really liked that turn of phrase. And then I started reading Robert E. Howard, and I'm like, wow, I certainly see where Frank Miller got it from.
Right.
It's like, oh, it's Call, it's Conan, it's every other protagonist.
A few of the antagonists as well, but not to the degree that Conan is. No, I guess getting back to the thing I was saying about the antagonist of the story, you said that Robert E. Howard kind of never does that switcheroo, or, you know, never kind of does the whodunit where there were no clues leading up to discover who the kind of the main villain of the story is. And, like, we as a reader get to see who that is right from the beginning. But a lot of times, at least in the Conan stories, Conan doesn't run across the big bad until, like, the middle or later in the story. Or if they do meet, Conan doesn't know who he's talking to. And again, you saying that Robert E. Howard doesn't cheat, that's kind of a way, well, I'm kind of torn. On the one hand, that's a way to be very direct with these characterizations and these physical descriptions in the game, and not cheat by just not having the characters meet the bad guy, because you're going to have to describe them so that they look like a bad guy, and the characters are going to go, okay, we know who it is. So on the one hand, yeah, keep them away or keep them separate. But on the other hand, that might get really frustrating for the players, where they haven't gotten to kind of the source of the problem until pretty late in the story.
No, I mean, that's a good point. I think one of the things, just to explain a little bit more what I mean by doesn't cheat, if there's like a selfish character in the story, the character would be selfish throughout the story, but selfish does not necessarily make them evil or bad or mean that they will betray Conan or Call or whoever. But when the character does end up betraying Conan, you're like, well, you know, that's kind of true to form.
Right.
Or when you flip it, when you have somebody who's a schemer and a manipulator but does have a sense of honor, I mean, that's been there right from when that character's been introduced. So at the end, when they spare the life of the protagonist, because, you know, you're an honorable man, you're a warrior, you don't go, well, why'd you do that? No, you're like, I know why he did that.
Yeah. No, that's a really good point. Yeah.
Yeah. So you could introduce because I don't want to make it sound like the characters in a Robert E. Howard story are simplistic. I think they're honestly presented. But that, and we've also get into, I guess, another thing with Robert E. Howard, and it touches on Conan. Conan is a pretty straightforward character.
Pretty. I think they very straightforward, yeah.
Yeah, very straightforward, but he's capable of very deep thought. I mean, online, our critics talk about the existential nature of Robert E. Howard stories and his protagonist.
Right.
So you have characters who define themselves, in a sense, by their weapons and their physical appearance, but they're able to have deep thoughts. They look at the different stages in their lives. You know, I'm a king now. Is that who I am, or am I the adventurer?
Yeah,
And so it gets into presenting things honestly or presenting things in a straightforward way does not necessarily mean you're presenting a simple story. Or if you're playing a character that's, you know, I'm a barbarian, I just want to be a barbarian that looks and acts like a barbarian. I don't need to be the atypical barbarian to play an interesting barbarian.
No, that's true. And I guess just digging even more into the Robert E. Howard doesn't cheat. In one of the Robert Jordan stories, I think he did a pretty good job of emulating Robert E. Howard's style. There's one story, I forget what it is, but I'm not going to spoil it, but you find out that one of the characters isn't what they appeared to be, and very close to the end, you know, they kind of reveal themselves as something completely different. And I remember feeling very cheated, because it felt very out of character for the Conan stories. And it wasn't until doing this cast right now that I realized why I felt kind of unsatisfied with that reveal, because there hadn't been any prior hints or descriptions as to what this person actually was.
Because Robert Jordan actually got me into the Conan books, because I just found the second short story collection and read that through, really enjoyed it, but then thought, well, I should probably go back and I should go and read some of the original stuff.
Right.
And really enjoyed those. But yeah, it was very much a modern retelling of Conan. It's very faithful, but yeah, there are certain changes to kind of update it. Certainly the way he treats women was a little bit different.
Really?
Slightly more honorable.
Slightly?
Yeah.
Like a hair's breadth, maybe?
Yeah.
So kind of building on what you said about you could play a kind of a, air quote, simple barbarian. But
deep, very deep.
Yeah, exactly, but very deep. I think that leads into our next element, which is the idea of the noble savage. And from what
I like
read,
how you said that, like, breath. Savage.
Oh, excuse me. All right. The noble savage. All right. From what I read, and which, in my opinion, comes through in the Conan stories, is Robert E. Howard's kind of seeming distaste for civilization and, I guess, high society. Because Conan's always saying, I'm not civilized enough to betray my friends, or I'm not civilized enough to do this terrible thing, and only you, quote, civilized people do those sorts of things.
Civilization is a way of robbing people of their vitality in a Howard story.
Right.
The more trappings there are, the more decadent things are. And when, I mean, you have a character who's like a Norman, and there's one point in the story where, like, all the French, I don't know, French civilization just gets stripped away, and he's back to being a Viking.
Hmm.
And that gives him the extra power to keep fighting on against the Mongol hordes.
Right. And that even goes for cities and locations, I think, because a lot of, at least in the stories I've been listening to recently, cities aren't described in good light, you know? They're always kind of cramped, you know, smelly, reeking, full of, you know, beggars and miscreants and stuff. And I guess that's kind of the tone of the story, because, you know, things are meant to be kind of dangerous and gritty, and that's how you do that. But there just don't really seem to be any good parts of the city or civilization. And it's always kind of the people who live outside the cities, or the, you know, civilizations that are kind of like nomadic or whatever, that seem to be, I guess, treated a little better or in a more positive light.
Yeah, no, definitely. He does have a way of presenting them negatively, or even though, like, you know, in some of our Warriors episodes, we've talked about actual warrior cultures where the elite would have like gold and very nice armor, very nice weapons, and all of those trappings. But when he describes warriors in his stories as having, you know, it's like aesthetically pleasing armor or weapons, it means they're ineffective.
That's a good point, yeah.
Yeah, or he'll make a case of saying, even though they have all that, they still looked hard in that.
Right, right, yeah.
Like everything is worn and very, like you said earlier, utilitarian.
Yeah, but...
And if you reach that level of civilization where you have the extra money for the trappings that you need to make things beautiful, then that just immediately falls into decadence.
No, that's a really good point. Yeah, if things look pretty, that means they're ineffectual.
Mm-hmm.
Except for the times when, and you're exactly right, they get described as pretty, but maybe there's that little bit of wear, or those, you know, little scratches that show, oh, they actually do know how to use those weapons you're carrying, or, you know, that really nice plate mail or breastplate that the person is wearing has a couple cuts across the front, or, you know, splashes of blood, which shows, despite being opulent and decadent, they know how to use it. So watch out for these guys. But those other guys who are there who are just all pretty, no, you're going to cut through them like butter. And they're probably going to be corrupt as well.
This is beauty that comes at the hands of humans. Like, if it's natural beauty, then that actually could just be beautiful.
Good point, yeah.
Yeah, because like you said, he does have, you know, from his background coming from Texas, he does have a love affair with nature.
So as you mentioned, you know, Robert E. Howard coming from Texas and having this love affair with nature. One of the things I read is part of Conan's distaste for civilization comes from Robert E. Howard's own distaste for civilization as a result of the oil boom. And I've seen, and some of the criticism of Robert E. Howard's work is that a lot of his characters are simply wish fulfillment, or kind of the Mary Sue characters, to put it in role-playing terms, where everything you aren't, or rather everything you want to be, is put into this almost near-perfect protagonist.
Yeah, and I mean, other things that play into that is that, like, Conan, or let me just do that again. Other things that play into that are things like the wandering protagonist. Conan travels a lot.
Right.
You know, the Crusaders. I mean, he has all these, like, short stories about the Crusades. And, of course, those are people coming from Europe and traveling to the Middle East, to the Holy Land, to seek fame and fortune. In one story, there's somebody who travels deeper into Asia to look for Prester John. Yeah, but Robert E. Howard is actually pretty stationary.
Yep.
Yeah, he didn't travel a lot. He kind of stayed in that part of the United States. And, like, looking at books and just casting his mind to all these, like, places in Europe and that, and then either writing about them directly through, like, his historical pulp stories, or putting like a thin veneer of fantasy over it in his like Conan or Call stories.
Right, the Hyborian Age. I wonder how many languages he spoke, if it was more than one, because again, Conan speaks like every language ever, just about.
I think he spoke Spanish because he spent some time in Mexico. So,
okay.
Yeah, and he's also from Texas, so I guess.
Yeah, probably. Yeah, safe to assume at least some Spanish, probably. But
yeah, I'm not really sure what you can do with this idea of wish fulfillment, or if that were really introducing anything new, because I think a lot of people do that.
I think you're right.
But I don't,
maybe, I think it kind of ties into the directness of the pulp stories, where, yeah, you're right, a lot of people play role-playing games to kind of have that wish fulfillment, and they build characters to explore that, and I think pulp stories or Robert E. Howard style stories pretty much give you a very direct message of, it's okay to do that. Maybe that's kind of what you are expected to do. And rather than it kind of being maybe like an open secret nobody talks about, no, it's just right there on the table. Everybody knows you're playing maybe an idealized, some kind of idealized version of yourself, or some, you know, kind of fragment of you that you want to, you know, expand into this full character. And it doesn't matter. That's fine.
I think that's a good point, that it's okay to do that. I think some people take games a little bit too seriously.
You're kind of talking about people who would say, no, you have to make the character real, and kind of like a real person.
Well, you have to make it real, or you have to make it respectful. What am I trying to say here? I mean, Robert E. Howard had one girlfriend, as far as I know. And as far as I know, he's probably pretty happy with that. Conan has one girlfriend every 5 pages.
Yeah.
And they're not really girlfriends.
You started to say one girlfriend, and I'm like, whoa, that is so incorrect. And then you're like, every 5 pages. Okay, yeah. All right, that is correct. Yeah, all right.
Yeah, but if people want to do that, I mean, that can be fun. I mean, you have to be respectful of everybody at the table, but maybe if everybody could just understand that people are here to have fun, and that can manifest itself in many different ways. And you know, there's different people. If you have people doing, if you can divide people between two factions, you have like the Munchkins, Power Gamers on one side.
Yeah, okay, Power Gamers, yeah.
Yeah, and then people who want to explore the story. But it's not to say that they both can't get together and play the same game. And if people just understand.
Another way to use this is, you know, we talk about spotlight time and kind of giving all the characters and all the players kind of that area of expertise, or that area where they could be awesome. And much like the wish, you know, much like the wish fulfillment thing, I think playing in a Robert Howard type of story, again, gives the players a very direct message that it's okay to kind of stand up and say, I'm going to be awesome at this thing because of what my character is.
Or I'm going to do something insane because I don't do crazy things in my life. You know, I work in an office.
That's,
you know, I look at spreadsheets all day.
Yeah, I wasn't thinking that, but that's another good thing. I was thinking like, okay, I've built this badass kind of min-maxed, for lack of a better term, character. You know, this kind of Mary Sue wish fulfillment character. I'm going to be awesome in this thing. So watch me be awesome in this.
Excellent. No, that's a good point. I mean, somebody min-maxes. Why are they min-maxing? Because, you know, that's what they want to do. You know,
right.
That's what they want to have fun. And there's different ways that a game master can deal with that. And one of them is giving them like in-game rewards, not necessarily experience or magic items, but, you know, adulation of the NPCs and spending a little bit of time. You know, we had that epilogue in our last big game, the 13th Age game.
Right.
That was like, okay, you guys did some pretty heroic things, and yeah, it's a big deal. So let's have a little bit of an epilogue describing what a big deal that was, and what would be the really positive consequences of you guys doing that. And it wasn't like, because we were just wrapping up that story and we were continuing with those characters. So it wasn't like, level up, guys. It was, hey, this is what happens. You guys are awesome.
Yeah, leveling up wouldn't have meant anything because, we're never seeing those characters again.
Yeah. So you're heroes. You're heroes within the story. And the NPCs are recognizing that. Instead of you play a game where the heroes, you know, save the town from the dragons, and then the next session it's, what have you done for me lately?
Right.
That'll be a gold, please, for you to stay in the scene. It's like, like, wow, you're amazing. Look at you.
Right.
Women throw themselves at the characters, or men throw themselves at the characters.
Well, I mean, like, no, that's exactly how it works. I mean, like, even if you're not talking, you know, kind of sexual stuff, I mean, men throw themselves
at, I know you were
but again, kind of using the gender roles from the Robert E. Howard stories, men throw themselves at the characters because they want to join up. You know, they've seen Conan be awesome. They say, wow, you know, that guy's incredible. I want to follow that guy because who knows what kinds of stuff he's going to get into. But he is, you know, this amazing fighter and I want some of that action.
You know who else does a really good job of that is David Gemmell.
Okay.
So he has that Druss character. He's introduced in the book Legend. And he's a few... Druss the Axe, I think it's called.
Oh, Druss the Axe, not Druss the Axe.
Dusty.
Yeah.
Yeah. And other characters in the story want to join up with him. People seek him out to help save them. Hmm. People want to drink with him. So it's not, oh, I want to drink with you to tell you about a troll. No, it's, I want to drink with you because you're awesome.
Right.
Yeah. Or and Conan, even if they don't know who Conan is or they don't know who Kahl is or these other characters are, they can see it. And this gets back into the physicality. They can see the awesomeness.
That's true.
And there's just something about you that makes me want to be near you. So, yeah, I know charisma is often a dump stat for people who min-max, but
yeah.
let some of the accomplishments assist in the charisma, if you will.
I was thinking, you know, the NPCs just kind of sit down at the player character's table to drink with them, not to give them, you know, a mission or anything like that, but just to hang out. I'm thinking, that might be kind of, it'd be interesting at first, but it might be kind of boring. Like, oh man, just once in my life, you know, once I'd like to have someone sit down and ask us to go out on a quest instead of just sitting down to kick it with us, you know? It's like, oh,
it's a good way to introduce NPCs that could be useful. Yeah, in a proper story, because now they get allies and it's not people they have to bribe, but they're getting allies that are like, okay, I know who you are.
Right. Yeah.
I'll help you. You did this. I also like when NPCs remember past things that the players did.
Oh, yeah.
So it's like, oh, you saved that town. You know, my sister's from that town or live there. You saved her. So right. I'm gonna help you with this. And you introduced that early in the story. It's like, this man doesn't pay for any drinks tonight.
That's why you're drinking free. Yeah,
that's why you're drinking free. And then you think, yeah, maybe it's just that. Or maybe it was like, you know, he's actually part of the guard.
Mm.
So they go and seek that person out if they need that ally. And you're just like, cool. We do this more in World of Darkness, but there's no reason why you can't do it in other games. It's like, for people unfamiliar, with World of Darkness, there's a system of merits. And some merits you can buy, like physical merits, we have players buy, but we often encourage them to not spend any of their experience points on like the social merits and that, but right, to earn it right. Through role play. So they can see through role playing the direct impact of that, of whether or not they get an ally or a contact. But yeah, you can incorporate that into any game, even if they don't have a mechanic for allies or contacts. It's just like, you did these things in this game and it's going to have these consequences, positive or negative. But
no, absolutely.
Certainly don't deny the players those positive consequences.
Right. I was thinking there's a little bit of a like kind of like the gunslinger in Conan as well, because even if the players or even if the characters in the story don't know who he is, because of that physicality and because of the way he's described, they know he can fight. And usually within like the first 10 pages or something, there's a bar fight. And it's usually because people are eyeing Conan up and say something about his Northlander appearance, you know, and then, yeah, there's a bar brawl. But you saying consequence, like, yeah, maybe the player characters are going to get to drink for free because of some past exploit. Maybe there's going to be, you know, that person who wants to try on some kind of like wrestling match, or maybe just wants to possibly, if you go dark, kill this famous person just to see if they can do it, if the characters kind of get famous enough.
Yeah, no, definitely the gunslinger effect or the every which way but loose effect, if people have seen that movie. No, Clint Eastwood? No? Okay.
Nope.
Yeah. All right. Oh, you know him as a director now? Okay. All right.
Yep.
Is the movie with the orangutan? No?
No.
Good movie, but he realizes that if you get a reputation as being a really good fighter, people are always going to want a piece of you or to test themselves on you.
Right. Again, gets kind of back to the wish fulfillment theme that we were saying, where, yeah, have the NPCs react to the player characters the way the players want them to react. You know, I built this character to look this way because I want everybody to know he's an awesome fighter. I want this guy to be, you know, the best performer in the world, and that's why I made this bard. And have the NPC react appropriately. Give the players what they want.
Yeah.
Fulfill those wishes.
Yeah. I remember the last time that we played Pathfinder, and we were treated as the saviors of the town before we even did anything, because that's what we were brought in to do.
Mm, yeah, yeah.
So we were put up in, you know, a nice place. We got access to the Duke.
Yes, the Duke.
The Duke.
Who we kept saying was the king, yeah.
So it wasn't like we were doing something important and then everybody treated us like garbage. No, we were felt like we were pretty special, and we had a lot of access to things. So.
Yep, they only started treating us like garbage when we started poking our noses in places they didn't belong and asking a lot of unwanted questions.
And accusing them of things and burning down somebody's factory.
Right, right.
Yeah, accidentally.
Then we started getting looked at sideways, like, oh, those guys.
Yeah. All right, well, that wraps up our episode on Robert E. Howard, one of our literature lessons. So certainly, if we were to sum up some of the elements that we talked about, one of them definitely would be language.
Yes.
And the language that you use both in preparing for the game and in the game.
Yep. Another one would be, I would say, directness, kind of both with the title, you know, the blank of blank, and with describing characters pretty much the way they are, or, you know, without kind of cheating.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then there's the idea of like the noble savage and just the conflict between civilization and nature.
Where nature always comes out of top.
If Conan is the force of nature, yes.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah. And an unusual point, just wish fulfillment and don't fight it.
Give the players what they want.
Yeah. We're like the Michael Bay of podcasts. I don't know. What is that?
I don't know what that would be.
I don't know. Does he get people what they want, apparently?
I guess so. But the Michael Bay of podcasts, we need a hell of a lot more explosions. And I think we make more sense in a Michael Bay movie. I hope we do.
Yeah. I don't know which one's Wayne, which one's Lyle, because they sound
right,
the same.
Right.
Chris is gone. Am I sad? I don't know. Is he coming back?
No. The music should tell me how I will feel. Yep.
Yeah.
And speaking of Chris and missing him and being sad, here he is again.
All right, well, thank you for joining us again on Out of Red Hands. Check us out online at www.idlereredhands.com, outofredhands.com. You can listen to the episode right there on the website, or stream it through iTunes or Stitcher, or download it off of DriveThruRPG. You can plus one us on G+, you can like us on Facebook, you can follow us on Twitter, or you can join up and talk to us in our forums. Those are at idleredhands.com/forums, and are hosted by Happy Jacks. Thank you very much, guys. Or you can send us an email at info@idleredhands.com.
Thanks a lot, and bye.
Bye.
Drive Through RPG. We average 9 new titles a day. That's over 60 a week. And we've got well over 15,000 RPG titles online right now. Drive Through RPG. The one true source for RPGs.
Idle Red Hands, recorded in Kobe, Japan. See us online at www.idleredhands.com. Music provided by Tripod Jimmy, and the song was Roadkill. Hope you enjoyed it. See you next time.